Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Understanding How Healthcare Disparities May Influence Your Cancer Treatment and Care. And today's program is supported by Novartis Oncology and an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC. We really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I want to cover a few things with you. First of all, there are over 129 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Philippines, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it is a global call, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Chassie Burrows-Walters. And Dr. Walters is a PhD in nursing, and she's Vice President, Chief Health Literacy Officer, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Walters will be addressing disproportionate burden of cancer and infectious diseases on people of color and how race may impact your access to oncology care, treatment, management of treatment side effects, and pain management. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Walters.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner, and thank you for the privilege of having me start us off today. I want to start by acknowledging that I am a white woman. I will be talking with you about race and ethnicity disparities today from that lens, but what I'm going to be talking about is what we find in the scientific literature as well as what I've seen and experienced as a clinician myself. Now, the topics we're going to be talking about today are sometimes hard to hear about, but it's really important that we have these conversations because I think we need to raise awareness. We need to talk about what's happening in order to make things better. So again, during my time, I'm going to focus on race and ethnicity. And when I talk about race, race usually refers to what we can see, most often the color of our skin, while ethnicity is really about culture, like where our family comes from, our beliefs, the traditions that we follow. And both can play a role in how we experience healthcare. And of course, today we'll talk specifically about cancer care. So I'm going to start with cancer screening. We know that people in certain racial and ethnic groups are less likely to get screened for cancer. The groups less likely to get screened, or experience many differences in healthcare for that matter, are usually minoritized groups. Now, minoritized groups are groups of people that make up a smaller percentage of the population, or in some cases, they just have less power. So I'm talking about race and ethnicity this morning. So broadly, the minoritized groups we're talking about are made up of people who are not white and not Hispanic or Latino. There are a lot of reasons why minoritized groups are less likely to get screened for cancer. The things that affect whether you get screened are often issues that are experienced more often by racial and ethnic minorities, like not having enough money to afford treatment, not being able to get to healthcare facilities, or not speaking the same language as what's conveyed by the healthcare system. And also, sometimes there's a lack of trust in the healthcare system itself due to someone being treated unfairly at some point. Now, I started by saying awareness is important, and that's because it's through awareness that we can change things. And I'll give you an example. For years, research demonstrated that Black females were less likely to get routine mammograms. Okay, we're talking about cancer screening. Now, because of the attention that that received, members of the healthcare community developed loads of programs and resources to try to make that better, and it worked. Now we're finding that Black females have the highest rates of screening mammography. Now, that success story is not true for all cancers. In fact, the overall rate of cancer screening is lower among Black, Hispanic, Asian, American Indian, Alaska Native people compared to their white counterparts. Now, this disparity or this difference impacts cancer care tremendously because the sooner we find cancer, of course, the easier it is to treat. So if we move on from screening, suppose a person learns that they have cancer, the next step is to see a cancer doctor or oncologist. For some people, it's easy. They have a car or other reliable access to transportation. The nearby hospital's got good cancer services. But for others, especially minoritized racial and ethnic groups, it's much harder. And this issue goes beyond race and ethnicity. But for example, many people of color live in areas with limited access to healthcare facilities that offer comprehensive cancer care. And for others, even when the facilities are available, there can be significant barriers to getting treatment. So all those things I talked about, maybe not having health insurance that covers all the costs, or they might have language barriers that make it difficult to communicate. And then when people do get treatment, it's not always equal. When it comes to cancer treatment, and I'm talking about things like surgery, chemotherapy, or radiation, not everyone gets the same quality treatment. Studies have shown that people from certain racial and ethnic groups are sometimes likely to receive the most effective treatments. Now, again, this can be due to a variety of reasons, including where they live or how much money they have, even biases within the healthcare system. So take lung cancer, for example. Radiation therapy is often used in combination with chemotherapy and maybe surgery as well to treat advanced stage lung cancer. But African American or Black people with lung cancer are much less likely, over 40% less likely, in fact, to receive radiation when compared to white people. Now, we need to do more to understand why that is happening so that we can make that better. And as you make your way through treatment, there are significant side effects to cancer treatment. They can be tough. They can be nausea, you know, feeling like you're going to throw up, fatigue, feeling really tired, or hair loss. Managing these side effects it's critical for a person's quality of life and their ability to continue on with treatment. But here again, there are differences when we look at different races and ethnic groups. People from minoritized groups might not get the same level of support to manage these side effects. They may have problems getting the medications or therapy that help for the same reasons that we've talked about, or they might not feel comfortable talking with their providers about symptoms, maybe for cultural reasons. And importantly, the lack of understanding on the provider side could also impact a person's experience. Take hair loss, for example, which happens as a side effect for some chemotherapy treatments. This is a well-known concern for people preparing to have chemo, particularly women. But for Black women, we see an even greater concern. And that's for a couple reasons. There's a cultural significance tied to their hair. And also, what we try to do to prevent hair loss, things like scalp cooling, those interventions were developed and studied to address hair loss in European hair. So, in fact, there's very little research on its use on Black hair, and in those studies that do look at it, they suggest it doesn't work as well. You know, pain is another one, very common side effect of cancer and cancer treatment, and the research shows that people of color often receive less pain medication than white patients, even when they're reporting the same level of pain. So this is a serious issue because it can, in fact, disrupt treatment. So I am at my time. I hope that you have a better understanding of why it's important to talk about these differences we see with racial and ethnicity disparities within cancer care. And from here, I'll pass it on to my colleague, Ms. Mendez.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Barros. That was just Dr. Walters, that was just a superb presentation. Stellar. And since you are the first speaker, you really set the tone for today's program. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Carmen Mendez, and Ms. Mendez is a master's in nursing and a nurse as well, RN. And she is a perioperative nurse liaison, LGBTQ plus cancer care nurse navigator, Josie Robinson Surgery Center, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Ms. Mendez will be addressing how culture, gender, orientation, LGBTQ plus, and religion may impact your access to medical care and access to cancer treatments in the LGBTQ plus community, the role of housing, cost of cancer transfer treatment, cost of cancer treatment, and follow-up care on your health. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Mendez.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you. And thank you, Chastity, as well. My name is Carmen, and I am a cisgender Latina woman with blonde hair and brown eyes. I am also an LGBTQI plus cancer care nurse navigator, which means that I work with people going through cancer treatment, helping them understand their options, get the care they need, and feel supported in a system that isn't always fair or easy to navigate. Today, I want to talk with you about two big things that affect a lot of people in our community. One is how your identity, like being LGBTQI+, your culture, or religion, might affect how you're treated in medical care, and how housing, the cost of cancer treatment, and getting follow-up care can create real barriers, but also what support exists to help you through it. Your identity matters and shouldn't be a barrier. Healthcare doesn't happen in a vacuum. Our cultural background, sexual orientation, gender identity, and religious beliefs, or those of our providers, can deeply influence the kind of care we receive or whether we seek care at all. For many LGBTQI plus people, going to the doctor isn't just about physical health. It's about emotional safety. It's about whether someone will respect your name, your pronouns, your relationships, and your body. I've met patients who've stopped going to appointments because they were misgendered. Others who didn't feel safe sharing their sexual orientation. Some who were afraid to be out because of how their family, community, or doctor may react. Healthcare systems were not built with LGBTQI plus people in mind, and part of my job is helping push those changes forward. For some people, culture and religion also play a role. Maybe a community sees illness as something private, or maybe there's a stigma around being LGBTQI plus. Maybe you've had religious trauma, or maybe your faith is a source of strength, but you're not sure how to bring it into your care. For others, religion or cultural traditions make it harder to talk about cancer, sexuality, or even ask for help. But none of that should stop you from getting the care you need. All of these layers matter, and you don't have to hide them to get help. In fact, the more we get to know about you, who you are, what matters to you, the better care we can give you. Now let's talk about something a lot of people don't talk enough about, the things outside of the hospital that affect your ability to stay healthy, like housing. Cancer care is hard, but it's even harder if you don't have a safe space to live. You might have to travel to get treatment. You might need a clean place to recover from surgery. If you're couch surfing, staying in a shelter, or facing eviction, it's almost impossible to keep up with care. This affects LGBTQI plus people more than others, especially trans folks and young people who may have been rejected by family. If you're in this situation, please know you are not alone. There are housing programs tied to cancer care, and social workers or nurse navigators just like me that can help connect you. What about cost? Even with insurance, cancer is expensive. Copays, medications, scans, transportations, it all adds up and fast. Many LGBTQI plus people work in jobs that don't offer paid time off, health insurance, or flexibility. Some people skip appointments because they can't afford to miss work or can't pay for a ride. If this sounds like you, please speak with your healthcare team. There are programs that can help with transportation, grants for medication costs, or payment plans. You shouldn't have to choose between feeding your family and treating your cancer. Then we have follow-up care. Getting through chemo, surgery, or radiation is a major accomplishment, but cancer doesn't stop there. You still need follow-up scans, blood work, and check-ins with your team. But many LGBTQI plus people don't have a regular doctor they trust. Maybe you've had bad experiences. Maybe you don't want to have to come out again and again to new providers. I hear you. But I want to encourage you to keep going, to find one provider who sees and respects you, because follow-up care can catch problems early, support your mental health, and help you recover more fully. Cancer doesn't discriminate, but too often our healthcare systems do. Whether it's being misgendered at intake, denied housing during treatment, or left without follow-up care because of cost, LGBTQI plus patients face unique and urgent barriers that deserve attention. So what can you do? You shouldn't have to fight for care, but sometimes knowing where to look can help you take those next steps. You can ask for a nurse navigator or a patient advocate if you don't already have one. They are there to help you find resources, coordinate appointments, and stand up for you. Look for LGBTQI plus affirming clinics or providers. Even if they're a little further away, it can make a huge difference in how you're treated. Reach out to support groups online or in person. For LGBTQI plus people with cancer, talking to others who understand can help you feel less alone. And please don't be afraid to speak up. You have every right to say, "This isn't working for me," or "I need a different doctor," or "Please use these pronouns." Your comfort matters. Happy Pride Month, everyone, and thank you so much for sharing your time with me.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Endes. That was really just a wonderful presentation. Quite elegant and really what a wonderful way to end your presentation. I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. It's just a stellar presentation. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Maria Chi. And Dr. Chi will be addressed. She's an oncology social worker, and she is a clinical oncology social worker. She's an author and researcher in healthcare disparities, social determinants of health, psychosocial oncology, and financial toxicity. And she'll be addressing social determinants of health, including languages spoken, health literacy, tips to find your best care team, and food and pharmacy deserts, food insecurity, tips to increase your access to health-promoting nutrition. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Chi.
Finding a healthcare or treatment team is so fundamental to your cancer experience because you'll likely be spending much of your time with them for this period in your life. They'll get to know you quite well, and it's important that you feel comfortable, seen, and heard by the people who have such a big role in your life. After your initial diagnosis, you may automatically receive a referral from the doctor who diagnosed you. Another place to start is to ask your PCP or primary care physician for a referral to an oncology specialist within your insurance network. Checking with your health insurance company is another important initial step, as they should be able to send you a list of oncologists on their insurance panel, meaning those doctors and hospitals or treatment centers whose services they will pay for. You may even reach out to friends and family who have experienced cancer for their recommendations. Don't be afraid to consult with more than one provider or treatment center, as you're entitled to a second or third opinion, which can be very valuable in determining the course of your treatment. You may seek an opinion at an NCI or National Cancer Institute designated comprehensive cancer center, which tend to excel in cancer research and treatment. But no matter where you decide to seek care, make sure the physician specializes in your particular type of cancer. A helpful question to ask them is, how many people with my type of cancer have you treated? Do you tend to approach cancer treatment more cautiously or more aggressively? Or with a standard treatment protocol or clinical trial, am I eligible for a clinical trial? You'll also want to pay attention to potential providers' communication style, or what we commonly call bedside manner. Are they listening to you carefully, answering your questions, asking you about your preferences within the scope of treatment options available to you? Are they taking any cultural or personal concerns or considerations seriously? How do they respond to you asking them questions? And if your treatment is something other than chemotherapy, immunotherapy, or targeted treatment, your team may also include a surgeon or radiation oncologist. From a holistic perspective, your healthcare team also encompasses nurses, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, medical assistants, social workers, etc. One question to consider is, what is the availability of these other providers and other support services for both emotional and practical resources at this treatment center? Now, zooming out a little bit to consider an even more holistic perspective, let's look at some of the factors in your daily surroundings that may impact your care, such as social determinants of health. Social determinants of health are conditions in our environment that affect our quality of life and health outcomes, both our risk of getting certain diseases and how well we do with them once we get them. There are five main types of social determinants of health: economic factors like access to job opportunities, our neighborhood, including our immediate environment and access to clean water, nutritious food, housing, and transportation; social and community factors, such as our exposure to certain structural inequalities, discrimination, or disparities, or opportunities to participate in meaningful social activities; healthcare factors, including our access to doctors, hospitals, and places for physical activity or exercise; and finally, educational factors, our access to quality schools, libraries, and language services, including information and reading materials in our primary language, and our community's literacy rates, including health literacy. In particular, having access to medical information in our primary language affects our ability to request, understand, or even participate in our medical care. Language barriers may lead to miscommunication between patients and healthcare providers, which also affect the quality and safety of our care. Health literacy is the degree to which we can find, understand, and use health-related information to make healthcare decisions. Our hospitals and treatment centers also have a responsibility to ensure access to material and services that we can actually use. For example, are there pamphlets and brochures or information on their websites at a level that most of us can understand without too much jargon or confusing explanations? Are they offered in our primary language? One thing you can do on a personal level is to advocate for yourself. Ask your healthcare provider if your clinic has an interpreter service, either in person or by phone, that can facilitate your visit. Now, referring back to another type of social determinant of health, the availability of nutritious, safe, and affordable food and groceries in your neighborhood. Not having consistent access to these things is considered food insecurity, which in turn can make chronic health problems worse. This affects approximately 41 million Americans. And related to food insecurity are so-called food and pharmacy deserts. Basically, these are neighborhoods with very few grocery stores or pharmacies, where you may have to travel a longer way to reach them. Technically, this is more than half a mile in cities and more than 10 miles in more rural areas. If you're homebound, have mobility issues, or are immunocompromised from cancer or your treatment, this makes access to getting groceries or medications even more of a barrier. There are some programs that can help reduce this barrier, things like Meals on Wheels, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, food banks, local religious organizations, and mutual aid societies. You may ask the social worker or patient navigator in your hospital or treatment center if there's a nonprofit organization that offers a free meal delivery service for people undergoing cancer treatment. These do exist in some areas. And equally important is to consult with an oncology nutritionist or registered dietitian about maximizing the quality and nutritional value of the food available to you, especially in conjunction with your medical treatment. This also underscores why choosing your healthcare team is so important for your overall cancer care. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. G. That was just an outstanding presentation. Just beautifully presented, and Dr. G, that was just so much information there and so helpful to our participants. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Jaramillo, and she is an oncology social worker. She is our Insights and Call Center Program Manager for Cancer Care. And she'll be addressing job commitments, access, transportation to treatment, and more, how telehealth may help in advancing your health equity, valuing your identity, tips to help you cope with health care disparities, and Cancer Care's free national programs and services, both our Hope Line and our website. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Jaramillo.
Thank you so much for the introduction and for the insightful information that has been presented so far. For many patients, getting treatment isn't just about scheduling a doctor's visit. It's also about figuring out how to miss work without losing a paycheck, how to get to appointments without a car, and also, as mentioned earlier, how to show up and feel seen and respected for those who are in a healthcare setting. As mentioned, these barriers can delay care, disrupt treatment, and add unnecessary stress to an already overwhelming diagnosis. Today, I will be briefly exploring how these factors can show up in people's lives, and more importantly, how tools like telehealth and patient empowerment can start to close the gap and promote health equity. Many cancer patients may face a dilemma of balancing treatment with work responsibilities, and some examples may include those who are hourly workers without paid time off, or contract workers who may risk income loss or job loss when attending frequent appointments. They may also not have access to employer-sponsored insurance that can cover treatments, leading to inability to pay for treatments and other basic expenses, also leading to financial toxicity. These impacts may include increased hopelessness, feelings of anxiety and depression, and decreased adherence to treatment. Geographic location can also be a barrier that increases disparities within cancer care. Patients who are in rural or low income or urban and underserved communities often lack local cancer care facilities. And for that reason, transportation barriers like not having a car, long distance, and limited public transit can lead to delayed diagnoses or missed treatments. Although the challenges we've discussed throughout this workshop can be debilitating, there are ways to navigate these challenges with practical tips. Some practical tips can include educating yourself in your rights in the workplace, as you may be entitled to family and medical leave. If you work for a covered employer and meet the criteria, you may be eligible for up to 12 weeks of unpaid job protected leave for medical treatment. You could also look into the Americans with Disability Act, as you may be entitled to reasonable accommodations, such as schedule changes, reduced hours, or remote work options. Asking your doctor for documentation to support your needs or adjustments can be the most advice tip. You are also encouraged to explore cancer-specific financial navigation services or psychosocial support. Many cancer centers and nonprofits like Cancer Care and other organizations that will be discussed later on can offer financial counselors, social workers, or navigators who can help you apply for copay assistance or charity care programs, or they can help you navigate Medicaid or Marketplace insurance enrollment, especially if you're uninsured or underinsured. And it could also help identifying emergency funds or grants for loss of income, transportation, or treatment-related costs. You can also ask your care team to connect you with a navigator or an oncology social worker who can help you coordinate appointments around your work schedule or assist you with any insurance and disability paperwork, as well as linking you with local or national programs for low-income patients or just patients that need some type of financial assistance. If you are unable to take off work, it is recommended to keep an organized, proactive approach to create a treatment calendar to track appointments and days off. Additionally, it is recommended to save all documentation with your employer and care team regarding leave or treatment accommodations. I also recommend to keep a list of questions for needs or other questions related treatments to every provider visit, especially if it's financial or logistical concerns with treatment. Bring a trusted friend or family member to appointments to help you ask those tough questions and to take notes. Please remember that treatment plans can be adjusted sometimes, and there may be alternative treatments that may be more affordable or flexible without compromising care. But again, you would have to have a conversation with your medical team about this. It is also advised to seek out for support. You deserve support. If you're struggling to afford care, don't assume there aren't any options. There are healthcare professionals that are equipped to help you navigate these challenges, like I mentioned, oncology social workers or navigators. It is normal to feel anxiety or hopelessness when finances and health collide, but please know that many cancer centers offer free or low-cost counseling or support groups. Telehealth options, whether they're with your oncology team or for emotional support, they can help you cope with stress and maintain treatment motivation, and also they may relieve some barriers to transportation or any related challenges. It also allows for more frequent, low-barrier check-ins between visits and improving continuity of care. It is essential to make sure that you know your rights in all settings and challenges you're experiencing. All patients are entitled to respectful, non-discriminatory care. Although it can seem scary or intimidating, please know that you deserve to seek advocacy from social workers, navigators, or legal aid. Lastly, health equity isn't a privilege. It is a right. Patients deserve care that meets them where they are, honors who they are, and helps them live with dignity through their cancer journey. Keep asking questions, seeking support, and using your voice. You are not alone. Cancer Care is here to support you as the leading national organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, and support groups over the phone, online, and in person, as well as educational workshops, publications, and financial and copay assistance. All cancer care services are provided by master's prepared social workers and world-leading cancer experts. To access any of our services, you may call our helpline number, which is 1-800-813-4673. Please remember, you are not alone, and we are here for support. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Hermerl. That was just a wonderful presentation, just superb in every way, stellar. Lots of resources for people, and I know there'll be lots of questions to you during the Q&A. So now we're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions. Bella?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So we have quite a few questions, so I'm going to this question for Dr. Walters. Are there specific language guidelines healthcare providers should follow when treating trans non-binary patients? Where can I find these resources? I do not always feel confident in the language I use and have been corrected by patients in the past.
Sure. Thanks, Dr. Messner. I think that the number one thing to know is to use the same language that the patient uses. So it sounds like this question might be coming from the care provider. I always say, you know, my name is Chastity. I use she, her pronouns. What are your pronouns? And you can ask the question, how would you like me to refer to you? What name would you like me to call you? And by deferring to whatever it is that your patient or your client asks to be called, that's really the best way, as opposed to making any assumptions. I also want to invite Carmen to see if she wants to add anything to that.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think just feeling out the patient first and asking the questions, it's okay to ask because not everyone, you know, it's not a textbook answer. So definitely asking what they want to be called, how they want to be addressed, and I think, as Chastity said, when you present your pronouns, it's inviting them to feel comfortable enough to also share theirs.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I hope this is a great resource for the person who asked the question. This is a question for Ms. Mendez. What are your thoughts on using search engines like Google to answer questions in a time where misinformation is everywhere? How do I know if a website is a credible source?
Sure, absolutely. I think it's hard, right? Because a lot of people like to use Dr. Google to get information. And the problem with that is that there is a lot of misinformation out there. And I think one of the good takeaways could be to make sure that the site is credible, that you're getting it from a source that's like a school or like .edu or .gov or or .org. You can also check websites like the Human Rights Campaign and the National LGBT Network. You can check to see who runs the website, what's the purpose of the website, where does the information come from, when was the information last updated, does the website ask for your personal information? Especially in today's, you know, climate, there's so much information going around, so it's really important to really research the sites that you're using.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I should let everyone know that, after today's program, we're going to send all of our participants a SurveyMonkey evaluation, which is an evaluation of the program. But you also will be sending everyone a number of the resources that our speakers have mentioned during the program. So, give us about a week and you'll get all that information as well, in addition to hearing it on the program today. I know that many of you are trying to write down that information, but you'll also be getting it in the SurveyMonkey evaluation. And so all of this evaluation, you'll also get resources as well. This one, a good question, and this one would be Ms. Mello. Can you discuss trying to maximize my appointment time? Sometimes after an appointment, I feel like I barely got to see and speak with my doctor, and I don't know how I can address this. I've come prepared with questions in the past, but we never get to them. Ms. Armello, could you address that?
Sure, absolutely. I think before even answering that, I think it's important to acknowledge how frustrating and how much of an added barrier this can be, especially for those who may struggle with fear, you know, of either treatment or may struggle with just disparities overall, right, just adding that barrier. But what I will say is that, one, you are not alone. This is something that, unfortunately, I often hear on the call center or people that I work with. And two, there are definitely ways to navigate this. I think one of the ways to navigate this is you know, if you bring somebody, a loved one or a family member, to your appointment, it can be easier to have a conversation with your medical team about it or with your doctor about it, right? So advocating for, you know, a little bit of time to go over questions, right, or even just sharing, you know, how distressing it may be not having answers to some of your questions, right? If you don't feel comfortable doing that, which is totally okay, I advise to seek for a second opinion as well, right? We often say this because if you don't feel comfortable with your medical team, the likelihood of addressing this is probably low, right? So finding someone who can pay attention to you as a person overall, right, and to your needs. So seeking a second opinion, and this can be by calling your insurance and seeing if there's any providers within your network, or if you do feel comfortable having this conversation with your medical team, asking your doctor if they can provide you with a second opinion. Because it is important to have that confidence and trust with your doctor that if you don't like something or if something doesn't feel right with you, to actually go to your doctor with that concern. And I recognize that that might not be the case due to some disparities or maybe your race, ethnicity, gender, sex, or gender identity, right, or any of those social determinants of health. So I definitely encourage to seek support for a second opinion or having, you know, that conversation. We also have the social workers here on our helpline that can provide some material on how to have this discussion or even just have a conversation on other ways that you can navigate this.
Excellent. Here, another question for you, Ms. Carmel. I have struggled with finding housing over the past few years and often move around, making healthcare inaccessible and inconsistent. How can I better adapt my healthcare to my situation? Can you recommend any resources or organizations that provide support?
Yeah, absolutely. So it can be a little bit tricky because any housing resources really depends on the state, right? So if you're in the state of New York, it might be different from the state of Florida, right? But at least a starting point, I would say, connecting with a social worker within your hospital or your treatment center, right? I think that would be one of the first steps to have that support, right? And if you don't have that, looking into any county or local community action organizations. Community action organizations are usually nonprofit or government-assisted organizations that can provide you with case management, emergency assistance funds, or even anything related to housing, right? So I always suggest going local first, since most cancer-related organizations may have a different type of support, which may be more for transportation or treatment-related. Not to say that this doesn't impact your treatment, it definitely does, but there may be some limitations. So definitely starting at a local level, so reaching out to the social worker, navigator, or anyone within your treatment team, even if you don't have or if they don't have any social workers or psychosocial support, if there's a nurse or nurse navigators, I know that in some centers they definitely provide support with some of these challenges and concerns. Lastly, again, you can also reach out to nonprofit organizations like Cancer Care. You know, if you're in the LGBTQ plus community, I know that the National LGBTQ Cancer Network also has a lot of resources. So just reaching out for that specific support can really be important.
Excellent, thank you. And from this, Dr. Walters, America has a racism problem, which is reflected in our healthcare system. Implicit bias training is needed for providers. Do providers have implicit bias training available to them? How do providers learn about this type of training? Dr. Walters, could you address this?
Sure. So what we don't have is a standard in this area across the nation. Most trainings are done at the organization level. So some folks are fortunate to work in an organization that does a great job with this. And you know, these trainings are not one time, right? The best way to do this is to, you might have a one-time training, but then you need to continue to sustain that. I often advise organizations when you're doing trainings like this, whether it's to do with race, ethnicity, LGBTQI plus health, to integrate those concepts into existing training. So those are, while they're considered best practices, I find a lot of places don't do them. So rather than kind of rolling off some resources, what we'll do is when we send the survey out afterward, we'll include some resources for trainings around race and ethnicity as well as LGBTQI plus health. So you'll have those links to click on.
Excellent. And do you want to mention the training that you're will be starting at Memorial Sloan Kettering?
Which one, Dr. Messner?
Oh, I think you're doing training of, there'll be training options available to healthcare professionals.
Around race and ethnicity or?
And LGBTQ plus community.
I want to make sure that, Carmen, do you know anything that I don't know?
No.
Okay.
No, I think I think she might be referring to what we were talking to about earlier.
External mm-hmm. trainings.
External
trainings. Yeah. So we'll list those in the email as well. Yep.
Okay. Because that'll be a really wonderful resource for our participants. And then I'm going to ask each of our speakers to provide a takeaway, so sure I didn't miss a question here. I've asked this one already. Ms. Harmelo, can you address this? Where should I start looking for housing assistance in my area? Are there any national organizations you can recommend to help with financial assistance and housing?
Yeah, sure. So in addition to the what I've mentioned before in terms of local organizations, I definitely suggest to look into government assistance as well, so any housing assistance, whether that's rental assistance or any emergency funds that can help. But also something I didn't mention were Catholic charities or other faith-based groups and organizations that may also provide some type of financial assistance.
And now I'm going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway from today's program, and I'll start with Dr. Walters.
Sure. I think what I'd like to leave folks with is that we all have a role to play in advocating for equitable health care, no matter who we are or where we are. So whether it's through supporting policies that try to reduce healthcare disparities, to raising awareness within our own communities, the places where we work, the places where we live, or just being more informed as people who go out there and get healthcare every day. Every action counts.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Ms. Mendez.
Hi, yes. I want to echo what Dr. Walter said. Definitely, you know, advocating for policies, especially in today's age where, you know, LGBTQI plus health is being targeted, you know, and advocating for policies that support housing security and universal access to health care and expanded financial assistance. Speak to your navigators, to your patient advocates. Look for those LGBTQI plus affirming clinics and providers, which we will provide links for you later on, and reach out to the support groups, and don't be afraid to speak up.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ms. Marmello.
Yeah, I would like to add that, you know, advocating for yourself can be taxing and it can be draining. So your emotional well-being matters just as your physical health, just as much as your physical health. And you deserve care that honors your whole self, and you have the right to receive it without judgment or discrimination. So if anything feels wrong or inaccessible, you have the right to speak up and seek advocacy and also support from others, from social workers, legal support, or trusted members of your care team. You deserve to be seen, heard, and supported. Health equity isn't a luxury. It is your right, and you are not asking for too much. You are asking for what's fair. So keep asking questions, keep reaching out, and know that your voice matters. You are not alone in this. We see you, we support you, and we're here to provide you with the supportive services you need.
Well, I just want to thank you. Our speakers were phenomenal, and our participants also phenomenal. This was a really great program. And although we have offered this program probably about a year ago, this program really was superb, stellar in every way. And I want to comment on the questions. So we did get to take a lot of questions. We couldn't take all the questions just because there's so many of you on the call. So for those of you who got to ask a question, please take your question to your treating healthcare team, because remember, they know the most about you. And again, there's a whole group of people on your healthcare team, which you may not always see. You may just be seeing your physician, but there's also there's patient navigators, there's financial navigators, nurse navigators, social work navigators. There's just such a number of people who could be assisting you. And so be sure to take advantage of your healthcare team. And for those of you who got to ask a question or who didn't get to ask a question and still in queue, take your question to your healthcare team. Remember that that team is there for you, and they're there to address your questions and ask your questions as often as you need to. Also, I just would like to, in concluding, indicate that none of you are alone. You're now part of a community of support, and we want you to know that that support is available, and we'll be sending you all those resources in addition to what you may know already, and those will help you as well. And we also have learned that somehow many of you have a hard time reaching your healthcare team on evenings, weekends, and holidays. So please be sure to check with the healthcare team how to reach them evenings, weekends, and holidays. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.